Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this Honorable Court.
Thank you. Please be seated.
This morning, the court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their presentation, they are Conoco Inc. versus WBD Oil and Gas Company from Travis County, Union Pacific Railroad Company versus Seymour Williams of Anderson County, and Rose Marie Clara Lentz versus Heinrich Rudolph Lentz from Bexar County. In each of these matters, the court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. We will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each argument and complete these arguments by lunch. The arguments are being recorded by our clerk, and you may purchase a tape of any argument for a nominal fee from the clerk of the court. We are now ready to hear argument from petitioner in Conoco versus WBD.
May it please the court. Mr. Walker and Mr. Patman will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Walker will open with the first 9 minutes, and Mr. Walker will present rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is a case about finality of contested case orders, generally about any contested case order, but specifically about one contested case order from the Railroad Commission that was adopted for specific panhandle fields in docket 1087-017. The court decided 56 years ago in Carzelius versus Harrell that the Railroad Commission has exclusive jurisdiction to determine these matters and that their field rules order, such as the one that's being challenged in this case, is not subject to collateral attack. The Administrative Procedure Act, which became effective in 1976, did not change that law. In particular, with respect to the requirement of exhaustion of administrative remedies and the rules that ensure the finality of contested case orders of administrative bodies. This court recently stated in the Cash America case that exhaustion of administrative remedies remains a jurisdictional requirement for a direct challenge of an administrative order. So we apply the applicable APA provisions to what happened in this case. WBD received notice of a contested case hearing. It chose not to participate in the hearing.
What if it hadn't?
If it had not received notice, then I believe that WBD could challenge, ask the Railroad Commission whether these field rules are applicable to it as the oil company in Torch versus Railroad Commission did. And the commission could make a determination, and WBD certainly has process available to it.
And what statutory authority would there be for WBD to do that?
To ask the Railroad Commission whether that applies? Well, I'm not certain what statutory authority there is to do that. It's the same statutory authority that Goodrich Oil Company used when it went to the Railroad Commission. All of the Railroad Commission actions involve notice and opportunity for hearing of some sort. Field rules hearings have the requirement under the APA that notice be given of hearing, but the Railroad Commission would entertain a hearing of that sort, as it did with FARTS and as it does with all field rules matters.
Approximately how many persons or entities got this notice?
I believe that the number of operators at the time was 1,200 in that range.
And how many of those made some kind of appearance? The commission know about?
I don't know how many made an appearance. The appendix that includes the proposal for decision and final order that is included in our petition for review and incorporated in our brief gives a list. There were, I think, in the nature of a couple of dozen parties who actively participated in all of the discovery and presentation of evidence and otherwise. The commission, recognizing the scope of the number of people who would be involved, also allowed people to register their interest in receiving mailings throughout the conduct of the hearing, but who did not want to be officially designated as an active party.
Has the commission ever acted pursuant to its rulemaking authority in enacting field rules?
No.
And is there a reason for that, a policy reason?
There is a policy reason and I think also a legal reason. The policy reason is that the Railroad Commission regulation of oil and gas is essentially a three-tiered process. The first tier is the enactment of statewide rules, rules of general applicability that apply to everyone no matter where they are in what field or how deep, whatever their operation may be. When a field is discovered, the operator and sometimes more than one operator will come in and ask the Railroad Commission to design spacing, density, production, and other requirements specifically for that accumulation of oil and gas. That is what the special field rules proceeding is.
But they could still do that pursuant to their rulemaking authority if they chose to pursue that route, it's my understanding. There's pretty much discretion there with the commission.
The commission has discretion to choose which procedure. Now, the Court of Appeals in the ARCO case said that when relative rights are involved and the commission is exercising its jurisdiction to protect relative rights, then that requires a trial-type hearing. The commission contends that that requires a contested case proceeding. That allows the operators who are competing with each other for these valuable reserves all of the due process protections that are afforded in the contested case procedures, which include rules of evidence, application of the ex parte rule, a very defined order that has findings.
Right. Well, I guess my question is, under the rulemaking authority, that same procedure is not contemplated, right? I mean, is evidence introduced? Can the operator still come in under the rulemaking authority and put on the same evidence, or is that just simply precluded?
They can present information. I look at it as that parties, persons, present information to agencies in rulemakings.
Well, it's public comment.
It's public comment. It's not sworn. I suppose it could be sworn, but the ex parte rule does not apply. There are other provisions in the rulemaking procedures that make it more of a general, informal, informational activity.
Well, is one of the reasons the commission chooses to go the contested case course, so there'll be finality to the field rules?
Certainly.
The appeal provisions?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's extremely important to the regulation of the oil and gas industry. And as this court pointed out in the Alcoa case that is cited in our brief, to the community as a whole, including taxing entities and all of the investors and owners of oil and gas minerals.
Is it on the contested case hearing? Can I send a notice to the panhandle that I'm going to consider whether or not the commission is going to consolidate all these separate fields up in the panhandle and send the notice and then decide as to a particular field that I'm going to change the rules governing that field?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, did that person get notice that the commission was going to do that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, how is notice to me that you're going to decide whether or not to consolidate fields notice to me that you're going to contemplate changing the rules on my field?
The notice in itself discusses it. It speaks of that.
Well, if the notice says that we're going to decide whether or not to consolidate the fields, and if we consolidate the fields, we're going to decide what rules should apply to the field. If you decide not to consolidate the field, is that notice to me that as to my field, you're going to decide whether or not my rules should be changed?
I'm not sure I understood your question, Your Honor. Could you restate it, please?
Well, if notice is an issue, have I received notice from the commission that the commission will be considering changing my rules if what the notice says is that they're going to decide whether or not to consolidate my field with another field, and if they do that, they will necessarily contemplate having rules for that field. Is that notice to me that they're going to consider changing my rules in the absence of the consolidation?
I believe it is, Your Honor, and if there's any question about the notice, the APA in the notice provisions requires a certain amount of specificity. It also provides opportunities with the operators with the opportunity to request of the commission more specific information about the proceeding itself. In this particular case, we don't have a challenge as to the sufficiency of notice as I read the petitions. That is not an issue in this case that's before the court today. I don't think there is also, and confident that there was no confusion at all among any of the operators as to what the scope and nature of this proceeding was to be. It essentially centered on the issue of high perforations and the disputes and uncertainties and problems that existed in all of the panhandle fields throughout that area.
But it makes a difference to your argument whether or not this is a contested case proceeding or a rulemaking proceeding, doesn't it?
It does.
And if the issue is that this is a contested case proceeding, then it would seem to be that the notice must pertain to whatever's being contested.
Yes, sir.
And if what the result of the commission's activity is an item that's within their purview to do, but it's not directly related to what the contest was that was before them, then doesn't it look more like a rate-making capacity than a contested rate case?
It might in the abstract, Your Honor, but I don't think that changes the nature of the proceeding that occurred in this case. It started out as a contested case, it went through all of the procedures as a contested case, and it ended up with an order as a contested case order with findings of fact.
But the order could be beyond the scope of the notice.
It could be, but I don't think we have that in this case. And I think also that when, as the hearing proceeds, as in a trial court, if issues come to the table and we're not necessarily in the petition or we're not necessarily in the notice, then the parties try it by consent. So that is part of the process. All of the people who were involved.
Some of the parties before the court trying by consent.
That's correct, and that is every individual's choice whether or not to appear and participate. And the final order was sent to all of the operators as well. So there was an opportunity for WBD as well as anyone else in the proceeding who got notice of the hearing and who was an operator in that field to challenge whatever the specifics of the final action that the commission had taken would be as it applied to them. So once again, I think complete due process was afforded in this case. We don't have a notice issue.
They could have challenged those specifics without having participated, you say? WBD could have challenged the final order without having participated in those proceedings, is that what you're saying?
Yes, sir. WBD could have filed a motion for a hearing to challenge any aspect, and should have filed a motion for a hearing to challenge any aspect of the final order that the commission signed.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court. Philip Hatman on behalf of Anadarko. I'd like to begin by explaining to you the difference between statewide rules and special field rules. This volume, relatively thin, holds the 100-odd statewide rules that, as Mr. Walker said, apply to every oil and gas field in the state of Texas. Those 20 loose-leaf volumes hold copies of the 14,000 special field rules that are in effect for different fields in the state. Each one of those, some of them are more than 70 years old, each one of them was adopted after a hearing procedure, a contested case procedure since 1976, without exception. Each of those actually, members of the court, is nothing more than an exception to one of these, and in fact, to only about 8 or 9 of them. The rules that are special field rules pertain, as Mr. Walker said, to density of drilling on a tract, to spacing of wells, to allowable production from an oil well or a gas well. Those fields have, each of them, different provisions, not necessarily different from each other, of course, but different provisions from the statewide rules. The statewide rules apply to every oil and gas operator. They apply to every field and every well in the state of Texas, except those which have received exceptions. Perhaps the court is familiar with the term Rule 37 exception, an exception to the spacing rule. These, in fact, should be viewed as a field-by-field exception to the statewide rule.
Why, as a policy matter, does the APA contemplate seemingly unlimited challenges to broader and smaller rules than it does through the contested case hearing, through the declaratory judgment provisions? I mean, I don't understand the reason for setting that that way.
Well, Justice O'Neill, of course, partly it's history, but in fact, it's necessary. The adoption of special field rules are decided by how far a well will drain.
I have no problem with that concept, that you've got the specific and the general. But why would the legislature, through the APA, allow the more general statewide provisions to be more liberally attacked through declaratory judgment is what I'm having trouble with.
Well, of course, I can't speak for the legislature, but the point is the statewide rules are general. They were not made and are not made by examining the engineering and geological and geophysical characteristics of a particular accumulation of oil or gas.
So if there had been no special rules enacted for the Panhandle Field, and the Panhandle Field is being operated under the general rules,
yes, ma'am,
then WBD could maintain jurisdiction for this case?
Yes, ma'am, I believe that to be correct.
And you'd say, as a policy matter, the purpose for that is they never had an opportunity to go put on evidence and witnesses to create an exception.
That's correct, but my time has expired.
Well, we cheated you out of some of your time.
So. Sir?
We cheated you.
Thank you, Mr. Justice. The point is, each of those is tailored to the particular characteristics of a reservoir. It's decided by the commission after a contested case proceeding at which technical witnesses, all of them experts, almost all, appear and present differing views with respect to the geology and the engineering, the transmissibility of fluids through the reservoir. And based on that evidence, the commission tailors an exception for this accumulation. The commission acts in a sense in REM, I hesitate to use that word, but the commission's regulatory authority, as commanded by the legislature for 80, 90 years now, is to regulate each common source of supply of oil and gas so as to protect correlative rights and prevent waste. And those are specific questions that are answered only in the most general way in these rules, because these rules were not adopted by tailoring prevention of waste and protection of correlative rights to the particular facts of a reservoir. And that's what those 14,000 rules do. And they're called rules only as a historical artifact. They've been called rules since 1930 in the Panhandle. That's in the record, 70 years, 71, 72. In other states, if that is of interest to the court, the same kinds of adjudications, maybe that's not a good word, that stirs up a nest, the same kind of determinations are made by police power regulatory agencies. And they're called proration orders, they're called spacing orders. The only reason that those 14,000 are called rules is because they've been called rules since the 1920s. And they are not. The APA has two structures, one for the general rules and one for fact-specific, and that's the way it should be and must be in order to protect correlative rights because of the essential fact questions that are decided when the commission determines that one particular common source of supply needs to be developed in a particular manner by placing wells so far apart, by placing so many wells on a track, and by permitting such and such an amount of volume of production. It's a big trouble in my time.
Any other questions?
Fired. Thank you.
The court is ready to hear argument from respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Ray, for the argument for the respondents.
Thank you. May it please the court. Mr. Chief Justice, members of this esteemed body, my name is Jim Ray. I'm here today with Michael Marson. We're representing the respondent, WBD Oil and Gas Company. We were the appellant and the plaintiff in the courts below. The issue correctly in this case is one of jurisdiction. Do the courts, specifically the Travis County District Courts, have jurisdiction to determine whether final orders promulgated, irrespective of labels, can and are being applied validly, statutorily, and constitutionally by the Railroad Commission? Finality is the issue.
But then the question is whether they are a rule. Is that fair?
One question, Your Honor, is whether they are a rule, but we don't depend solely on the rule issue to establish jurisdiction. We believe that we have vested rights in property and other constitutional issues that vest jurisdiction in the Travis County District Courts, irrespective of Chapter 2001 of the APA.
WBD does not contest that the proceedings held back in the 1980s were a contested case as a proceeding under the APA. Isn't that correct?
I cannot agree with that statement.
That was the nature of the proceedings, given what others who had noticed did in terms of challenges to the administrative relief that was granted and so on. There's no complaint from WBD that was a contested case.
The complaint from WBD is that they use contested case or evidentiary trial type procedures, but the effect of the...
Okay, so the answer to my question is that WBD does acknowledge that was a contested case proceeding.
No. No, Your Honor. WBD acknowledges that they use contested case procedures to make a rule.
I understand that, but they did use contested case procedures, and you're complaining about the fact that they did that. Is that right?
Actually, that's not true either.
Okay.
What we're complaining is that they used a process to promulgate a rule, and now they're construing it as something different, and they're applying
but
it to
WBD. I understand, but if you look back at the record of what occurred back in the 1980s, that was a contested case proceeding as contemplated by the APA. Does WBD acknowledge that?
No. We acknowledge that there was a proceeding before the Railroad Commission that was noticed for a rulemaking that used evidentiary trial-type procedures.
Well, didn't it walk, talk, and look like a contested case proceeding? I know that you say that the result was rulemaking. But did the entirety of the proceeding follow the parameters of the APA for contested case in terms of the procedural requirements that the commission and those who participated followed? Didn't it follow the procedures of the contested case proceeding?
Justice Hankinson, I would disagree for this reason, because the notice that they sent out was for something different. The order that they promulgated in the proceeding described what they did as something different. The order that they enforced in the rule in the panhandle described something different.
I understand that. I understand that you say that what they did was rulemaking, but I'm just talking about, if you file a civil lawsuit and you go to the courthouse, you know that it walks, talks, and looks like a civil proceeding under Texas procedural and statutory law. And so my question is, didn't this all, in terms of the way the proceedings were conducted, follow the parameters set out in the APA for contested case proceedings?
I would agree with that.
Okay, that was my question. I was trying to figure out if there was something about the way it was all conducted that put it outside those parameters, but you say no, it really fell within that.
No, ma'am. Your Honor, we believe that what they ultimately did walked and talked like a contested case. We don't believe that the result of what they did matched what they did.
I understand that, but I'm looking back at the beginning and looking at the entirety of the record.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Mr. Ray, it strikes me that the fundamental difference between the parties in this case is the way they reason through it. You start at the end and reason backwards. You start with, we've got rules. Let's go back to the hearing. It was adjudicative in nature. Therefore, it should have been rulemaking. They start with, under the APA, we can decide at the point we notice it which way we want to proceed, which route we want to take. And those are fundamental disagreements. It strikes me that the APA sort of contemplated that by setting out these two procedures, giving tremendous discretion to the commission to decide which way to proceed. And then once they made that decision to proceed a certain way, it would be up to WBD, for example, to come in and contest which avenue they choose to take and resolve it at that point. But once they've chosen an avenue to take, the rules are pretty standard or pretty set as to how you're going to proceed to attack anything that comes out of the proceeding. And so isn't our fundamental question here our starting point? I mean, not what results from the hearing, because we can get into what's a rule generically and esoterically and what's adjudicative, and clearly what happened at the end, working your way back, is a hybrid of these type functions. But it seems to me the starting point is where the commission chooses to proceed and the discretion they have to do that. And once they exercise that discretion, how you characterize the proceeding or how you characterize what results is really irrelevant.
Justice O'Neill, I appreciate the comment, and I've certainly heard that from the other side in this lawsuit, but I think that the starting point is important, and what I would like to look at is what the starting point really was. The starting point for us is that we already had vested rights and rules as they existed for more than 50 years. And those rules were vested entitlements that WBD was entitled to rely upon for several reasons, not just because the well bores and the minerals themselves represented vested rights, but also because the law, the statute at the time, House Bill 4, Section 481.141 to 143 of the Government Code, said that WBD was entitled to rely on the fact that those rules would govern their well bores during that period of time. That was the law.
The statewide rule.
Yes, ma'am. And the panhandle field rules, because one of the definitions of a rule under 2001.
Well, again, you're starting at the end.
Well,
I mean, that's the fundamental difference, is you're starting out with these ended up being rules rather than looking at the discretion the commission has at the beginning. So we've got to resolve that issue first off.
I think that that's probably true. The only more fundamental issue would possibly be the jurisdictional aspect of the proceeding and the parties. What we would proposed to the court is that they never acquired personal jurisdiction over WBD, and so if it were a contested case proceeding.
Well, in what was the notice deficient that WBD received?
I provided for the court's convenience a copy of the notice that was sent out. The notice describes a hearing for the purpose of repealing final orders and establishing and looking into establishing a consolidation of several fields into a single field. And the condition on that, the establishing of field rules, it would be appropriate if such an activity occurred, neither of which did. This notice is not adequate under due process considerations. If rights vested under the constitutional protections of this state...
Why did all these other people who participated know what was going on and come and participate?
I think that if you look at the list of the participants, what you're going to find is they more nearly aligned with the business interests that were promulgating the change than they did with the folks whose interests were adversely impacted. If you look
at
our
paragraph 6, it says parties attending this hearing may propose other rules and or alternative field rules and should submit evidence to support any proposed rule as it relates to waste prevention, oil and gas conservation, and the protection of parental rights. Doesn't that put you on notice that not only is consolidation, and if yes or no, but that they're also going to be talking about alternative field rules, so that's up for grabs.
Justice Owen, I would disagree with that, because we believe that you have to read the notice like you would a statute. We have to look at it in its entirety. We believe that this was more like what you would call notice and comment. We invite your participation in a public event. We're considering doing this consolidation of large fields. We're considering making new rules. The proposed rules that they considered were on starting at number 5, moved over to page 5 and page 6. None of that happened. The notice, however slight, about the possibility of amending field rules for the existing field, we believe would be constitutionally and statutorily inadequate. But it certainly wouldn't go to the jurisdiction. That would seem to be to the merits of the case.
This wasn't published in the Texas Register.
No, ma'am.
So clearly they were not contemplating it as a rulemaking procedure. Because they'd have to publish it in the Register if they did.
It's my understanding that under the ad hoc entitlements of an administrative agency like the Railroad Commission, they could either proceed by case-by-case adjudication, which is what this would be, or they may proceed by notice and comment rulemaking, which does require publication in the Texas Register.
And because they didn't, you knew which way they would proceed.
No, ma'am, because either one is, under the decisional laws of this state and this court as I read them, they're both deemed to be rules. We've dealt with that at least 3 times at this court, in the Lone Star case, recently in the Rodriguez opinion. There's several cases that have looked into the PUC and the Railroad Commission conducting matters of this nature, utilizing ad hoc evidentiary trial type procedures. But before my time expires, I think it's important for us to understand that WB had absolutely no duty to intervene in a contested case proceeding. If this is truly a contested case...
But it's hard to understand when you say you have such important constitutional property interests that you get this kind of notice, you just decide not to go, I take it. You read the notice and thought, well, we don't have to do that. And then for 6 years after the order issues, nothing happens. I mean, if the rights are so important that they deserve that kind of protection, why didn't you show up and do something sooner?
For a very simple reason. Just as you would in any adjudicative position, if you found out about a lawsuit that was not a class action that hadn't gone through a certification process, Texas law does not impose upon you a duty to intervene in that proceeding. The second thing is we have unique rights that are different than most of the rights that are described in this contested case proceeding and rulemaking.
But the order came out in 1989. And then you knew what they had done.
That's correct.
And nothing happened then either.
No, ma'am, because they never enforced these rules for more than 2 years. It was not until 1993 that the Railroad Commission brought their first enforcement or challenge of these rules against certain operators.
But was WBD aware when the order became final with the rules contained in it?
Yes, ma'am.
You were put on notice of that, too.
We were put on notice, and I attached as an exhibit to our brief on the merits the type of notice that people got. All operators were told they had to follow the field rules. Now, that the field rules, a definition of a rule under 2001.038 and the definitional section that follows from that also includes the repeal of a rule. That's one of the core definitions. Assuming for the sake of argument that the state's position is correct, that only a statewide rule would be a rule subject to challenge, if you go down their path of argument, these are exceptions or repeals or revisions. Wholesale changes are exceptions to the statewide rules, and under the definitions, clear as they can be, they would constitute rules subject to challenge that way, I believe.
The amici are unusual, perhaps, in their volume and unanimity. This opinion brings down the administrative state. What's your response to that?
Having been on both sides of the amicus problem, I can tell you that aligned with this table are large moneyed interests and large associations, and there's remarkable similarity in many of the amicus briefs. The PUC wrote its own brief, and I think it was the more compelling, probably. I didn't believe, however, that there was that much difference between our position and theirs, in that finality is our objective also. Our belief is that it is a core legal position. The rules that apply to us are the rules on which our rights vested. These Panhandle field rules made a wholesale revision. They rescinded and they repealed over 70 field rules that had their inception in over a half century worth of experience.
How were those original rules adopted? Weren't they adopted in the contested case procedure?
No, Justice Owen, because the contested case procedure never even existed at this point in time. And that's an interesting point, because the Railroad Commission is one of the most progressive agencies in the history of our experience. What they have done predates the APA. They didn't recognize the difference in their process between a field rule hearing and a contested case proceeding until the APTRA, the precursor to the APA, came out in the late 70s. They have always proceeded under a trial-type evidentiary format.
And what's wrong with that?
Nothing.
Because it allows greater investigation, greater voice from the participants, greater comment, evidence. It's a more intensive fact-searching procedure, and it would seem to me that would be the better procedure that all the parties would want, is a more thorough vetting that is not really contemplated in the rulemaking process.
And I couldn't agree with you more, Justice. The problem is, when you get through doing that more formalistic approach to problem-solving, to inquiry, you still end up with a rule. All we want to know is whether or not that rule is valid as applied to us. We believe that we have substantial constitution and statutory basis to challenge the rule. We're not, at this point in time, trying to determine whether or not the rule is good, whether it's lawful, unconstitutional, otherwise. We simply are asking the court to allow us to go forward.
But the one point that the amici make is that if we take that position, it allows similar challenges to all of the other rules.
And those similar challenges, Justice Heck, I believe are available to every state law that's on the books as well, and there's no floodgate of litigation over that. In other words, you're entitled, when someone applies a statute to you or a rule which has the effect and is construed as such, you're entitled to challenge its statutory applicability or its constitutionally as applied to your unique facts, and that's what we did. What happened is this created such wholesale chaos in the panhandle that a whole cottage industry of litigation occurred. People were out buying wells in the middle of oil fields like our clients own so that they could bring suit for damages under the Natural Resources Code for violating rules that didn't exist when the wells were completed. That is the nature, that is the essence of what we don't allow in this country. That is an impermissible retroactive application of the law. We were sued like that. We were sued for money damages, not by the Railroad Commission, by somebody who used to work for us that didn't like us anymore. They went and paid $7,000 for a well and bought...
Is this in the record?
Yes, it's in the affidavit of WBD's president, Dumbawant. The problem here, and everybody's been accused of getting a little into the facts, but the problem here is I contested the validity and applicability of these rules because we were sued not by the Railroad Commission for noncompliance. We were brought to task by a competitor. He just wanted to seek an economic advantage by a loophole in the law. That's all. And there's another problem here, and that is they want to apply res judicata principles to this contested case order, and we were not a party. If, as Justice O'Neill says, if this is truly a contested case, and if this is truly following contested case procedures, then our rights could not have been adjudicated because we were not parties to it. A contested case proceeding, by its definition, only adjust rights between parties.
But you could have been.
That's correct.
And isn't that critical that you could have been?
It is critical because Texas has never adopted anything like a requirement to intervene in someone else's litigation. This is, although administrative action is...
But this is not someone else's litigation. This is your litigation because you are an operator.
I respectfully disagree. It is not my litigation because my rights, I believe, legally, had already vested under a wholly different regimen, a wholly different regime, a wholly different set of rules and statutes that applied to me. We didn't care whether they took five or six previously identified as separate fields and combined them into one because all of our production comes out of the same stratum. We don't have all the complex issues that seem to be asserted here. Our rights were certainly not represented.
In making a special field rule, has the commission ever named a party in a contested case hearing?
Not in any hearing that I've been a party to. I don't know the answer to that. I would suspect not. If there's an enforcement proceeding, they would say, Justice Rodriguez, you must attend because your rights are going to be affected. If there is a contest between Conoco and Northern, for example, one that is pending, the parties were actually named. In this particular situation, you're just invited to give your opinions as to what would be a good thing to do. And we think that simply meets the definition of a rule. It's something that implements or interprets or prescribes law or policy. We think it is fallacious argument to say that they adjudicated the legal standards for lawful compliance in the panhandle field. And then to apply an adjudication of a legal standard to operators using preclusive effect, whether it's called res judicata or collateral estoppel, that is a foreign concept to me, and I've not been able to find any case authority for that. This has also come up in the federal forum before, and we've cited a couple of cases in our brief for that. The FERC did the same thing that the Railroad Commission has done, and many agencies have done that. I don't think it's open to discussion that they are not entitled to do it. But due process, according to the Fifth Circuit and the other cases that I've read, entitles a non-party to challenge the validity of the rule if they were not a party. And I think that that fits the paradigm here. And all we're asking is that we be afforded that opportunity.
See if I'm clear, because I may not be. You say you're not a party here, and some of the concern is you got notice, and maybe there was some sort of obligation for you to come forward. Maybe you were, by that notice, made a party to this contested case. Let me explore this with you. You've got an interest in a field, and you've got some current rules that are in existence that allow you to drill wells within 500 feet of each other. And you get a notice from the commission that it is considering changing rules applying to the panhandle, that the wells will have to be 750 feet apart. and you get that notice that they're considering that rule change. Now, do you think you've got an obligation to appear before them based on that notice to participate in that, or do you think you are not a party to that litigation, and if they pass a rule that says it's now got to be 750 feet, you can sit back and not do anything until the Railroad Commission marches out on your property and says, plug that well that's too close? Are you a party to that contest that's coming in, or are you not a party to that contest that came in?
See, I think that goes to the heart of the matter. The question is, if they sent a letter to Jim Ray and they said, irrespective of your constitutional rights or your vesting or any other thing, we're going to plug a previously valid and lawful well.
No.
I think that I would have the right to challenge it two different ways. One is, I could go directly to court and say the Railroad Commission is acting in excess of its statutory and constitutionally conferred powers, and we need an injunction. The second thing is, I could participate in that hearing because I would be made a party. Under those circumstances, I think clearly what you described would make me a party. If I was made a party, then I think I would be constrained to follow the contested case procedures to...
So what makes you not a party in this case is because the notice, the rule changes were conditioned upon the commission making one large field as opposed to keeping the fields out.
That's correct. Our position is that this notice right here would not support a default judgment. If I was standing before you or someone else was standing before you in a default judgment situation, I think that what we would be saying is under the Mullane case, the Manzo case, and all the cases that this court has written on due process issues, and due process clearly attaches here. I think everyone would concede that. The notice has to...
In most of these cases, let's suppose an offsetting operator came and filed a complaint against you and asked for relief, didn't ask for specific relief, but said, you know, I'm being drained, I want you to amend the field rules to protect, or the special rules to protect me. You couldn't enter a default judgment on that petition, but you could certainly grant relief, and you would be bound by that, wouldn't you?
That's correct, because they had named me as a party.
What's the difference?
Because they've named us as a party. I looked at this as in-depth as I knew how with the meager skills that I have at research. The rule of law that I came up with is that Texas did not recognize defendants by implication under the APA or any other legally binding authority that's entitled to finality and preclusive effect. You either are brought into and made a party of a proceeding, or you intervene and join. If you're not, then under the decisional laws of the nation, under the Supreme Court authority that I've seen, under the case law of this court, it's my belief that due process does not attach unless the notice is adequate. And we don't think this notice was adequate to tell us that our due process, our vested rights, would be adjudicated in absentia. I'll ask y'all in conference to read this notice carefully and see what it says. I think it is a conditional document, and I don't think it would support a default judgment. And I think that we're
that's my point. When an offsetting operator sues you or asks for an adjudication in front of the contested case here, you can't necessarily hold up their complaint and render a default judgment on it because it's asking for open-ended relief. So that shouldn't be the test, should it?
Wouldn't the test, Justice Owen, wouldn't it be whether or not the tribunal had acquired personal jurisdiction? We're not going to contest that they have subject matter.
And how do they get personal jurisdiction over you in that sense?
They serve us.
With what?
With a complaint. There's a notice pleading requirement at the Railroad Commission, just like there is in courts. It's titled differently, but you still have to be served with a piece of paper, and due process notice attaches. I mean, every
but how's the notice that you get in that kind of case different from the notice that you get in this case?
My name would appear somewhere on the face of that document, and I would be commanded under the authority of the state of Texas to appear at a date certain to answer a complaint that's been filed by a specific person under authority of a specific set of rules that apprises me of the conduct that I'm accused of and provides me with an adequate opportunity to present my objections. And
so you're saying when the commission on its own decides it's going to hold a contested case hearing and lets everybody say, come in and bring your evidence because we're going to set rules that's different, and it cannot, under any set of circumstances, be a contested case hearing.
And Justice Owen, for this reason, when they say we're going to make rules, that would be like calling an assembly of the legislature in saying, everybody come to Austin, we're going to set a new law about a matter, pick a topic. You're not obligated to hire a lobbyist. You're not obligated to intervene in some sort of hearing. You're not obligated to present testimony, and you're certainly entitled to come before this court and any other one and say that the rule of law that was promulgated by that legislature is deficient in some legally significant way. Either it's outside of the authority granted to the body, in this case the Railroad Commission.
Yeah, but if the local zoning board said we're going to zone this area of this community and you have an opportunity to appear before our hearing to talk about that, that's a different scenario because one statewide and one applies just locally and maybe are exceptions to a statewide provision. I mean, that seems like the closer analogy.
Justice O'Neill, I like that analogy, and I'll tell you why I like that. Because prorating, apportioning the production of oil and gas is much like zoning. It's the right to use your property under what circumstances and how and the intensity. And that is a legislative undertaking. However, if that same city council or a group of city fathers grants you a building permit and you go out and you pay that fee and you build a two-story house, you're entitled to rely on that building permit, and they cannot come out to you 3 years or 75 years later, or in this case, 50 years later, and say, we've rethought the idea, and two-story houses just aren't pretty, and you're going to have to saw off that top floor because rights had vested that are protected under due process. You see what I'm saying? It's the act of government that defines the activity that you're entitled to complain about. One is the right to use property, and the other is a property interest itself. Here we have vested rights and property themselves that have attached, due process attached to that, and Justice Jefferson, no, you could not appeal what they're talking about because under the APA, if you don't file a motion for rehearing, then you're not entitled to appeal. And if you look, if you would, sir, under tab...
If you don't file a motion for rehearing, but you could have filed a motion for...
You could if you were a party, but in Q, the Railroad Commission denied the people party status. Once they found out that this was a trick, that this was a defective notice, and then instead of doing a consolidation, did not come out to you 3 years or 75 years later, or in this case, 50 years later, and say, we've rethought the idea, and two-story houses just aren't pretty, and you're going to have to saw off that top floor. Because rights invested that are protected in the new process. You see what I'm saying? It's the act of government that defines the activity that you're entitled to complain about. One is the right to use property, and the other is a property interest itself. Here we have vested rights and property themselves that have attached due process, attached to that, and Justice Jefferson, no, you could not appeal what they're talking about because under the APA, if you don't file a motion for rehearing, you're not entitled to appeal. And if you look, under tab...
If you don't file a motion for rehearing, but you could have filed a motion.
You could if you were a party, but in Q, the Railroad Commission denied the people party status. Once they found out that this was a trick, that this was a defective notice, and then instead of doing a consolidation appeals and passing rules that were going to be inapplicable, instead, we're going to delve into things that were otherwise thought to be impermissible. A number of parties tried to intervene, and that is right here on Q. They had a hearing as to whether or not to let them intervene, and the answer was no. I think that there, at some point in time, has to be accountability. Finality is one thing, and we believe in finality. Our finality is the rules and the rights that were vested 50 years ago. They came out and passed new rules that retroactively apply, not to how a zoning board would do, not to how the wells can produce, but how the fundamental assumptions, how they can be completed. You'd be no different than
I think you're on our time now, unless there's a question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
I'm not sure where to begin. I'll say this. Texoga amicus brief represents in the very beginning that they were filing that on behalf of the producers and owners of more than 90% of all oil and gas production in Texas. This isn't big guy versus little guy type of case. last argument of denying party status, no one was denied party status in this case. I don't know what that referred to and how that applied. Reference to federal cases, the Shell case is one that WBD cited. Shell was not given notice of the prior adjudicative proceeding that they were challenging a statement of law that the agency that the FERC decided in that case. That's distinguishable from this. WBD did receive notice. Justice O'Neill, I think you asked a question at one point about why the APA, why the legislature provided a more general type of review of rules than it did for contested case, if I understood your question. It's because the procedures that lead to the adoption of a rule are more general. The type of judicial review, I think, is tailored for the type of procedure at the agency. In comparison, the type of judicial review for a contested case is much more specific. It's confined to specific findings of fact and conclusions of law. The order, even looking backwards at what happened here and trying to figure out what the law is, even looking backwards, the order that was entered in Docket 1087-017 was a contested case order. It had findings of fact that were specific to geologic conditions in the field that were determined and intended for all of the operators to be able to rely on and to go through that contested case process so that finality would be reached, and not reached within 2 years for procedural challenges as available under the APA for challenging a rule, or indefinitely for constitutional statutory authority problems that is available for challenge of a rule, but final within 30 days after the order is entered, which is what the APA requires a petition in the district court to be filed for challenging a contested case order.
Under what circumstances could the commission itself reconsider these rules?
If there are changed conditions in the field, there's case law, I think the Magnolia Petroleum case is one. It can do it if new evidence comes in. Also,
somebody files a proceeding, or the commission initiates it, or
typically it's when somebody files a proceeding. This proceeding was initiated by the oil operators, in essence. It was not initiated by the gas operators. It was initiated by a letter to the railroad and some other matters that were going on. Another way that it happens, and is also pertinent to the facts in this case, is that WBD can go to the Railroad Commission and seek an exception to these field rules based on any unique conditions under its lease. That's what Rule 37 exceptions do. That's what WBD could do in regard to where it can perforate its well. Since in the Panhandle field, gas operators and oil operators are separate property owners in the same lease, the location of the perforation is the same, in essence, as lease lines are where operators own both oil and gas. So we have that relative right on a vertical plane as well as on a horizontal plane. So WBD has all of those processes and procedures available to it, and it did not choose any of those. The notice, if the court looks at the notice, it is sufficient. But that was not challenged in WBD's petitions. They did not challenge the sufficiency of the notice. Also, we don't have a default judgment. We have a judgment on the merits of the case. So it's not a judgment saying we accept all of the allegations of fact as true in the petition. That's like a default judgment would do. It goes through and it makes numerous findings of fact and conclusions of law, sets out numerous standards for when a well is properly completed. And that gets to the point where WBD is talking about its vested rights. The vested rights that WBD has must be acquired in conformance with the statutes. The critical statute in the question of perforations is Natural Resources Code 86.097. It was adopted in 1899. It provides that an operator may not produce gas from an oil well when the gas is in a stratum that's not associated with the oil. That was adjudicated. Whatever rights they might have are dependent on compliance. matched with the law. And the Harrington case, which is cited in, I believe, my reply brief, has a similar circumstance where in the East Texas Fields, an operator completed his well in a slant hole under another operator's lease, even though the operator reported to the Railroad Commission that his well was within the 3% deviation. Whether WBD's perforations are compliant or not is a matter for the Railroad Commission to determine.
If we were to decide that WBD, the declaratory judgment piece of the APA does not vest jurisdiction in the district court here, what then?
I believe the court has two options. What we ask the court to do is to render judgment that the courts did not have jurisdiction to determine the validity of the order in 1087-017.
Well, I guess my point is there have been a lot of other bases raised for jurisdiction that the Court of Appeals didn't address.
That's correct.
And I don't get the impression they're very thoroughly briefed here. I realize they're mentioned, but it appears the bulk of the briefing, both from the amicus briefs and everything else, is focused on the rulemaking versus contested case.
Yes, Your Honor, and that, frankly, is our predominant concern. However, every single one of those issues should have been raised in a direct appeal of the order itself. The APA in 2001.174 includes as basis for reversal challenges to constitutional problems, challenges
all
to
right,
statutory
so
problems, and everything else.
If we were
else.
To decide that this was a contested case, then it would be they didn't exhaust administrative remedies by bringing all those questions within 30 days of the, and we wouldn't have to deal with those other issues here. Is that correct? It'd be a preservation exhaustion of remedies point.
That's correct. WBD has not challenged action of the Railroad Commission. WBD has not sought an exception as it applies to their particular lease. Should those occur, WBD would again have the opportunity for judicial review of any and all of these issues, but the order itself will be valid going into that proceeding. And that's our concern, is to have this order determined valid because it is final. It should be considered conclusive.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument in the first clause. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.